Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 131, The Mysterious and the Communal, Part 3. Once again, reading from Vine Deloria Jr.'s book, God is Red, published by Fulcrum, F-U-L-C-R-U-M, and his 1970 bio from another book, We Talk, You Listen. Vine Deloria Jr. was born in Martin, a border town on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. He was a Standing Rock Lakota from a distinguished family of American Indians with scholar, churchman, and warrior chief ancestors. A former executive director of the National Congress of American Indians, he was also a member of the Board of Inquiry on Hunger and Malnutrition in the USA and of the National Office for the Rights of the Indigent. He held degrees from Iowa State University and Lutheran School of Theology. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Continuing a bit of a summing up from last time, comparing the spatial vantage point of the native ways versus the temporal, and also the more practical experiential versus the more theoretical abstract. So it continues on with the concept of history. One of the major distinctions that can be made between the tribal religions taken as a group and the Christian religion that underlies Western secular thought is the extent to which the two views were dependent on the idea of history. The Western preoccupation with history and a chronological description of reality was not a dominant factor in any tribal conception of either time or history. Indian tribes had little use for recording past events. The idea of keeping a careful chronological record of events never seemed to impress the greater number of tribes of the continent. While the Indians who lived in Central America had extensive calendars, the practice of recording history was not a popular one further north. The way I heard it, or it was a long time ago, usually preferences any Indian account of a past tribal experience, indicating that the story itself is important, not its precise chronological location. That is not to say that Indian tribes deliberately avoid chronology. In post-discovery time, some tribes adopted the idea of recording specific sequences of time as a means of remembering the community's immediate past experiences. The best-known method of recording these experiences was the winter count of the Plains Indians. A large animal hide, usually buffalo, would be specially tanned, and each year a figure or symbol illustrating the most memorable event experienced by the community would be painted on the hide. Gradually, the hide became filled with representations of the years, and it would be maintained as long as there were people who could remember what the figures and symbols meant. Other tribes devised methods of recording community experiences similar to the winter counts. The Pimas and Tohono O'odhums of Arizona had calendar sticks on which symbols were carved. By remembering what the symbols represented, a reader could recite a short chronology of recent years. But again, the ability of the reader limited the extent to which the history could be recorded. Lacking a sense of rigid chronology, most tribal religions did not base their validity on any specific incident dividing human time experience into a before and an after. No tribal religion was dependent on the belief that a certain thing had happened in the past that required uncritical belief in the occurrence of the event. Creation, gifts of powers and medicines, traumatic events, and the lives of great religious leaders were either events of the distant past and regarded as such, or the memories of the tribe were still vivid and occupied a prominent place in the people's perspective and understanding of their situation. Salvation and religious participation in communal ceremonies did not depend on the historical validity of the event, but on the ceremonies and powers that were given to the people in the event. The tribal religions had one great benefit other religions did not have and could not have. They had no religious controversy within their communities because everyone shared a common historical experience, and cultural identity was not separated into religious, economic, sociological, political, and military spheres. That's another thing that Deloria talks a lot about in the book. I'm paraphrasing his exact terms, but he talks about the Christianity as kind of losing touch with the more of the religious sense and becoming more of a societal political sense, like how he describes certain gatherings, say Christian gatherings, could be more like a social club, or how just look at the politics of the day and how so much of the we think of the South or the red states as more Christian, how it's become less connected to the true religion and more connected to these other economic, sociological, political things, and of course that flavors into the military. How many times have we heard, with a political speech and God bless America? And a little speech by Chief Seattle, I'm just quoting the ending here because it's significant, talking about the white man. Your time of decay may be distant, but it will surely come, for even the white man whose God walked and talked with him as a friend with friend cannot be exempted from the common destiny. We may be brothers after all. We shall see. So another thing that Deloria mentions in the book is kind of like how somewhat, I mean, things are changing nowadays, I think, but somewhat it's like so entrenched has been this programming that in a way the disassociation with the native ways or the land is sort of, for a lot of people it's like not happening. but hopefully optimistically that will change. But I think what Deloria is saying is kind of a sobering realization of how entrenched the system is. And perhaps, nature, Mother Nature can, I don't wish for that, but sometimes these severe weather events, force people to come together. So Mother Nature can do her thing too. And some other quotes here. The Iroquois, for example, relate that they once lived on the plains, but then migrated eastward. when is not important to them, but their relative hardship on the plains and eventual prosperity in the East are important. The whole basis for the Christian belief in life after death was the alleged resurrection of Jesus after he had been dead for 3 days and his subsequent ascension into heaven. As the Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles were written, there can be little doubt that the primitive Christian community wished its converts to believe that Jesus in his physical body had risen upward to heaven in a cloud. Early converts saw visions in which he returned on the clouds. When Jesus failed to return within the lifetime of those who had been his closest associates, the religion should have folded. But as the original groups grew smaller and the religion spread to Asia Minor, the initial prediction was continually modified so that while the basic idea had been an immediate conclusion to history through divine intervention, its immediacy gradually became symbolic, not historic. That's another distinction riffing off of last show, is that how much the other religions tend to get into this symbolic, theoretical, maybe it did happen, whereas the native ways are more based in actual history. So it's sort of like take your pick. Do you want actual history in a timeless sense, or do you want a bit of the fanfare in a sort of entertainment sense? That would be my interpretation. After several centuries, however, several centuries of the Christian religion appear to have been filled with miraculous acts of God and direct assistance to the Christian martyrs. After several centuries, however, even this tendency ebbed, and with the establishment of the organizational church as a political power in the crumbling Roman Empire, a Christianity adopted the temporary doctrine that Jesus had established a, quote, church to supervise the affairs of men until he decided to return. This condition of nearly total church control over the lives of people was strengthened during the centuries that followed, and for many centuries the political struggles of Western Europe had to have Christian approval to be considered valid. The Protestant Reformation was instrumental in breaking the control of the organized church structure over the political and economic life of Europe. Since that time, while the political structures have continued to expand their power, the relative influence of the church has declined. And he's also highlighting how this thing about some of the Christian belief that until the doctrine had been worldwide, that Jesus would not return, as if Jesus's return, it gives this justification for the proselytizing and colonizing, that the world can only be saved when Jesus is spread far and wide. In this sense, the technological, he mentions technological sophistication, which is often mentioned by native peoples, the technology, and where is it, what does it do? So you have this sort of modern technological, I would call it this sort of messianic complex, where there's perpetual upgrading of technology, and it's always chronologically look on to the next best thing. And he also highlights how sort of what happened in the U.S. when this colonists came over to Turtle Island, really it was sort of happening or practiced, so to speak, elsewhere. The original thrust of Christians opposing pagans translated itself many times in Christian history. Shortly after the discovery of the New World, Christianity was thought to be opposed on the one hand to the societies of the New World and on the other to the heretics of Europe. The peoples of the New World were virtually destroyed by the European invaders at the same time that Europe was being ravaged by witch hunts, the Inquisition, and religious wars. The tendency of placing Christianity against the social or political forms of man's secular existence continues to this day. After World War II, planetary history was seen as a struggle between godless communism and the chosen people of God, the Christian nations. And also he highlights what Stephen Newcomb has highlighted in his book, Pagans in the Promised Land, the whole doctrine of Christian discovery, which is an essential aspect of history. And then Deloria says, Christian religion and the Western idea of history are inseparable and mutually self-supporting. To retrench the traditional concept of Western history at this point would mean to invalidate the justifications for conquering the Western Hemisphere. Americans, in some manner, will cling to the traditional idea that they suddenly came upon a vacant land on which they created the world's most affluent society. Not only is such an idea false, it is absurd. Yet without it, both Western man and his religion stand naked before the world. So this is a whole thing of, to me, it explains why, you know, people en masse and sometimes individually, we wonder, you know, why is somebody stubborn or they don't want to look at a new angle of something. And it's because their whole system is based on something, and to begin to look at it, you know, risks their whole system changing their, you know, entire view. And here's where he sums up that, you know, what I've mentioned before is sort of look at the results of Christianity. It is said that one cannot judge Christianity by the actions of secular Western man, but such a contention judges Westerners much too harshly. Where did Westerners get their ideas of divine right to conquest, of manifest destiny, of themselves as the vanguard of true civilization, if not from Christianity? Having tied itself to history and maintained that its God controlled that history, Christianity must accept the consequences of its past. Secular history is now out of control, and its influence has become a rather demoniac, disruptive force among nations. This is part and parcel of the Christian religion. If the lack of a sense of history can be called a shortcoming of tribal religions, as indeed it can, overemphasis on historic reality and its attendant consequences can certainly be assigned a bad grade for the Christian religion. And the next chapter of the spatial problem, history. If one were to take the last 2,000 years and the events of that period as representative of the validity of the Christian religion in bringing peace on earth, then there would be little question that the religion is incapable of invoking any significant peaceful change in people or their societies. And no one can say when the creation story of the Navajo happened, but everyone is fairly certain where the emergence took place. Indian tribes combine history and geography so that they have a sacred geography. That is to say, every location within their original homeland has a multitude of stories that recount the migrations, revelations, and particular historical incidents that cumulatively produced the tribe in its current condition. Traditional Cherokees today can still tell their stories about the sacred places in Georgia and North Carolina that illuminate the tribal history. The Sioux, Cheyenne, Kiowa, and Arapaho all have traditions that describe Bear Butte in South Dakota. And in Wyoming, the most notable characteristic of the tribal traditions is the precision and specificity of the traditions when linked to the landscape, a precision lacking in most other religious traditions. And he gives mention to a book, Worlds in Collision, was attacked by respectable scientists even before it was published. A concentrated effort was begun to force the Macmillan Company and the author of Velikovsky's publisher to stop the presses. Scholars began a boycott of Macmillan's textbook division, its most vulnerable place. The conspiracy of silence dropped over discussion of Velikovsky's works. He subsequently published Earth in Upheaval, which was an embarrassing revelation of geological shortcomings. Now here he's getting into someone presenting stuff that is different from the system, you know, whether it's on a historical level or even a scientific level. Charles Fort comes to mind as someone who, you know, debunked the whole scientific system as an incomplete system. And here Delory is showing how the whole system can sort of debunk this guy. And then I think he goes on to say that eventually a lot of his findings were, you know, years later were proven accurate. But he mentions the sun as an electrically charged body. Donald Menzel, a Harvard astronomer and one of Velikovsky's most bitter critics, ridiculed the idea. And then this goes on in this book, Worlds in Collision, has great relevance for religious thinkers. Velikovsky's original point of departure was the belief that the Exodus was an event of worldwide significance and experienced by peoples on a global basis. He's talking about how perhaps the Exodus, the parting of the Red Sea and all that, was actually due to a natural disaster, you know, maybe floods or something, and so has a historical context more so than a symbolic or religious context, and how that might connect with, say, the Hopi, who have flood stories, and that these might be actually physical events. And so then we get into sort of how to survive and how to deal with these things, not just, you know, what does it mean on this abstract religious level. in the end of this chapter, Spatial Problem of History. The Old Testament is probably extremely accurate in many respects, particularly when describing those events that changed the way people understood their world. It is difficult for many people to accept the fact that the Old Testament is primarily an effort to record first Hebrew and then Jewish history and not a volume of divine admonitions about the nature of ultimate reality. But it is entirely possible that events recorded in the Old Testament and believed to be highly religious are also described in the legends and folklore of other peoples and not given the same religious significance. Our responsibility today is to discern from the many different human traditions the probable historical sequences that have shaped our modern earth and come into closer understanding of the nature of the planet on which we live. And there's an emphasis, I find that. It's like how, like Rodney King said, can we all get along? Can we get along with this earth? And can we look at our stories and say, oh, this story is similar to that story, not, you know, your religion is nonsense, so let's go to war. And on a personal note, I found fascinating, he mentioned several times where the Hebrew tradition, he mentions similarities with the native peoples. Hopefully I can find some of those quotes later on. And he also mentions Zechariah Sitchin, who's written some interesting books about other planetary travel. And, you know, he says some of the analysis is very, he finds very accurate, some of it a little out there. But, you know, here's Deloria, very open-minded and giving credence to these other points of view, which... You know, it shows the native inclusivity in the context of this type of literature. And chapter 8, Origin of Religion. There's a lot of good stuff in here, so just ought to wrap up this third and what's aiming for about 6-part series. Suppose Emmanuel Velikovsky is correct. Suppose that instead of the Exodus accounts being a poetic elaboration of religious doctrine of a later time, they are fairly well-remembered accounts of the phenomena encountered by the Hebrews as they left Egypt. How, then, do we approach religious writings? Are they to be understood as actual events, and do we take all religious stories as having been real events at some time and some place in man's experience? It would seem that we have a major task of discovering to what extent we can accept the historical veracity of any story of ancient times. That Velikovsky's projections about the nature of the physical world would continue to produce startling verifications would tend to make us hesitate, reflect, and take another look at religious doctrines, symbolisms, and beliefs. The Western conception of a homogeneous time experience apparently has many roots. Certainly one influence can be said to have been Greek philosophy and its insistence on the uniform operation of nature. This idea surfaces continually in Western thought, and it continually intrudes into theological doctrines about religion and the nature of God. So strong has this idea been that natural events have been forced into this interpretive pattern, even when the facts warranted otherwise. For many centuries, peoples of Western Europe believed that the heavens being made by God at creation were constant. The appearance of meteors and comets was thus a great embarrassment because these phenomena seemed to indicate that the heavens were not all that stable. Was this possible in a divinely constructed universe? Present-day astronomers are searching the records of other societies for evidence of a supernova that occurred on July 4th, 1054. It was one of the spectacular events of celestial history, and it apparently lasted some 3 weeks and was clearly observable at various parts of the planet because it appeared quite close to the moon in its crescent phase. In at least one cave in California and on rock carvings and paintings in Arizona and New Mexico, there are representations of a crescent moon with a bright object quite near it. There are speculations that the early peoples of North America saw the supernova and made these records to verify for subsequent generations that such a thing had happened. There are very few references to this event in Europe, where the social science of history was fairly advanced. The reason that there are very few records in Europe is that everyone believed that the heavens were constant, thus people did not really see what they were seeing. In view of this startling victory of faith over experience, is it any wonder that contemporary theories of the nature of the Exodus fall apart when they are examined? If people become so blinded to their observations that their beliefs override their actual experiences, would it not seem possible that the whole method of interpreting events needs drastic revision? In another day, perhaps, the rock paintings in the American Southwest would be taken as a primitive form of religious poetry. theologians, historians of religion, psychoanalysts, and other wise people would put forth books about the primitive ideas of the natives, who could not know that no extremely bright star exists beside the moon at its crescent. Fortunately, today we have sufficient fragmentation of knowledge so that astronomers can use Indian rock paintings as verifications that the supernova was observed. Because it is possible, indeed highly probable, that American Indians observed and faithfully recorded a celestial event while their supposedly more civilized neighbors in Europe were gritting their teeth, reaffirming their faith in the Christian religion and refusing to see the supernova, the whole question of the interpretation of religious symbols, doctrines, and beliefs should be re-examined. Suppose we find in the tribal traditions a memory that is not only more correct in many aspects than that of the Western religions, but suppose that we find in them the longer and more extensive history of humankind. That prospect has not been considered by Westerners, yet it is precisely the consideration that must be made if Western societies are to be released from their religiously ethnocentric universe. It reminds of Sherlock Holmes telling when Watson looks and doesn't see something, and Holmes says, "You looked but did not observe," something like that. And continuing, in short, what we have previously been pleased to call creation stories might not be such at all. They might be simply the collective memories of a great and catastrophic event through which people came to understand themselves and the universe they inhabited. Creation stories may simply be the survivors' memories of reasonably large and destructive events. It does bring to mind the whole thing of sort of miraculous stories, and it's kind of like, you know, the tendency is to believe them without questioning the source. You know, it's that way with the Bible a lot. You know, the hundreds of, or however many years after the time of Jesus, and you know, who's to believe what. And it, you know, it seems to play out in the modern times with the media. The media is kind of like the new religion, the opiate of the masses in a way, because the amount of percentage of people that believe the lead up into and the invasion of Iraq, and the amount of lives and trauma that has been caused because of that, and it just sort of gets avoided as what a brainwash and numbing effect that has had. And here he compares some of the religious history to the Hopi. The first Hopi world was called Topka, and it was characterized as a world of endless space. Topka was considered to be the original world, and the basic themes that are found in some of the tribal legends about the nature of creation are found in the descriptions of this world. It goes on to describe the Hopi surviving the rain of fire and then a flood, and so it's again interesting to see that whether that is connected to his actual events. And then he goes on to compare the Near Eastern religions. Near Eastern religions, for example, appear to have only one recallable beginning. Both Genesis and the Enuma Elish of the Babylonian records indicate a beginning in a world of waters. Do these records extend only to the third world of the Hopi? Were there societies capable of passing on a longer history of humankind in the Near East, or were they destroyed by one of the earlier catastrophes visited on the planet? Now that is super fascinating, because he's recording in the Hopi worlds, and now we're in the, you know, to some the fifth world, to some going from the fourth to the fifth world. But he's saying that perhaps some of the Near Eastern religions, their interpretation of the creation is only a third world of the Hopi. So in essence, they're presenting a limited world view of actual historical geology, or whatever you want to call it. It was just like a fascinating thing to ponder, the whole conception, you know, how people follow what they, you know, either believe or experience as the beginning. And now we mentioned the Navajo. When we turn to American Indian tribal religions, we find a number of similarities also forming a pattern of interpretation. The Navajo legends begin with an account of the emergence of the Navajos, or first people from the underworlds. Quote, the first three worlds were neither good nor healthful. They moved all the time and made the people dizzy. Upon ascending into this world, the Navajo found only darkness, and they said, we must have light. Unquote. The Navajos then separate light into constituent colors of white, blue, yellow, and black, representing the colors of the sky during the 24-hour period of rotation. So there again, you have the symbolisms, the color connected to actual, whatever you call it, you know, observational or scientific or, you know, the actual historical landscape. Pawnees and Arikara also speak of ancient people emerging from the darkness into a lighted world. The Pueblos are led by Mother Corn, plant life, into the new world of light from the world of darkness. The Mandans climb a vine rope from the underground until a large woman proves to be too heavy for the rope and breaks it, leaving some of the people remaining under the earth. Other tribes have had variations of this general theme of emerging from the underground, where they had survived a great catastrophe or at least begun their existence in this present world as a people. So again, yeah, that also ties into the sort of Christian end of the world, spooked out view. You know, if they haven't looked at the science of perhaps what was then considered natural catastrophe, or however the weather patterns, and if we're looking at the what are now the world, what one could call disasters or catastrophes, looking at what's happened in Nepal recently and what's going on with climate crash, if we can get past that religio-scientific view and look at these in some other way, that seems to be where a lot of why the natives, indigenous peoples are, you know, there's this resurgence of their voices and respect for them. While the theology of the Old Testament appears to focus on the Promised Land as early as the time of Abraham, it is with the emergence of the Hebrews as a migrating nation into Canaan that the community and the land merge into a psychic and religious unity. From that time on, the people orient themselves around the idea that God has given them this particular piece of land. Even those people in Jesus' time who sought the return of the Son of Man as the Jewish Messiah looked for a military hero to restore their land ownership. The translation by Christians of the fanaticism of the Jewish resistance to the Romans in the days of Jesus into a misunderstanding by the Jews of the nature of the Messiah has always been a difficult interpretation for the Christians to make. By substituting heaven for the tangible restoration of Palestine to the Jews by driving the Romans out, Christians eliminated the dimension of land from religion. And necessarily, their theology had to change Hebrew tribal memories of a particular land into a generalized statement about the origin of the world. So there, a simple, you know, word messing with words, as today the powers of be still do in their legal bullshit. You know, corporations are people and that kind of stuff. Here we have that the word heaven, you know, becomes, it puts the religion into this abstractness and denies the practicality. This feeling of the importance of land is also present in Western countries, but it has undergone a radical change. It has transformed itself into patriotism on the one hand and religious nationalism on the other. With this transformation, the whole nature of religion and land has been lost. Land is no longer a major element in Western religion, but forms a tangential influence, often manifesting itself whether or not the Christian religion intends that it do so. And I'll just put a little plug in for my new book, Drive Through Theofascism and the Hero's Journey, because that I mentioned that in the book, you know, the sense of the disassociation from land and the driving through it rather than being with it. And again, he mentions that Jung, Carl Jung, before the rise of National Socialism, Jung said he could see in the psychological problems of his German patients the symbols of old Germanic religious myths that were to later mark part of the development of Nazi fanaticism among the young. Do we attribute the ability of young Germans to dream in ancient religious symbols to a desire to escape from Christian rigidity, or perhaps to a residual power in the land itself to produce certain religious mythologies and figures? And wrapping up this chapter and this part of the series, if the old Germanic myths of Wotan can reassert themselves in a modern industrial state, which Carl Jung believed he could document in the rise of National Socialism in Germany, and if the practical political program of the Nazis was the conquest of additional lands for living space, that was one of their things, Lebensraum or something like that, and the generic reunification of Germanic peoples, we cannot avoid an examination of the relationship between lands, spiritual energies, and peoples. Land must somehow have an unsuspected spiritual energy or identify that shapes and directs human activities. Religions must not be simple expressions of ethical and moral codes, as we have been taught. They must be more complicated manifestations of the living earth itself. And this aspect of religion is something that American Indians of all the peoples on earth represented and continue to. So that's a key thing too, that these religions must not just be ethical and moral codes and, you know, thou shalt not and right and wrong and that stuff, but that it needs to be connected again with the experience and the realities of the moment and the land and all the relations and the way that, you know, the Indonesian, that tsunami a bunch of years ago where the indigenous and the animals were some of the only, the bulk of them survived through their intuition and their awareness of the animals and the lands and the vibrations and all that. And the last paragraph of the chapter, this sentiment, talking about, is in reference to an Indian chief talking about, you know, his ancestors buried in the earth and that their blood and their, you know, the soil is actually made of the part of the ancestors. This sentiment is considerably greater than a simple allegiance to abstract religious principles, even to principles that purport to give instructions in cosmic salvation. It speaks of an identity so strong as to be virtually indistinguishable from the earth itself. The human being, as it were, completely in harmony with the Mother Earth and inseparable in every way. Nowhere else on this planet do we find this attitude, and it bears further examination. So again, I guess, you know, it depends on your view and your background, how much you connect, but to the native peoples, that this indistinguishable, you know, the connection of connection with the Mother Earth, that is literally part of who they are, and not something to escape from and get away from, and that it's, you know, it's literally part of the religion, spirituality, or whatever you call it. So thank you very much for listening, and have a good one. And we'll go out with a powerful song, sort of haunting music and powerful lyrics by Bruce Cockburn called Indian Wars. Of the land.
itself.